right. Turn with me. Can you guys hear me? Am I on? Turn to Matthew chapter 13. If you are a guest, we're going to be showing you the verses on the screens. Each Sunday, we like to take a passage from the Bible and we teach on it. Our passage this morning is a parable. That's just a story that Jesus tells. And this one is one of the parables found in Matthew chapter 13. But as you're turning there, let me ask you a question. What would you do if you were God? What would you change if you were God? What would you do differently? One of the greatest parts of my job as a pastor is being involved in our Bridge course. It's a course designed to help people who are not Christians understand what true Christianity is all about. And by far, the biggest problem people in Bridge have with God is how he's running the world. Why all the suffering and evil? Why does God allow bad things to happen? What would you do if you were God? I posed this question to Google, and one woman, a response I found, she said this: I would do so many things to fix this crappy world. Mortality, disease, the need of living beings to kill one another to survive. Seriously, this place is so messed up, I'd have to redo it all over. What moron designed it in the first place? That about sums up what I've heard thousands of times. Why does God allow evil? Well, Matthew 13 gives us an answer. It doesn't tell us everything that we want to know, but it tells us that God is not only aware of what is happening, he's intentional about it. It's part of his plan. Now, that may sound hard and confusing, and we may not like his plan, but Jesus explains that there are reasons that this is how it's going to be. Look at Matthew 13, and we're going to read in verse 24. It says, Jesus put another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared also. And the servants of the master of the house came and said to him, 'Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have weeds?' He said to them, 'An enemy has done this.' So the servant said to him, 'Then do you want us to go and gather them?' But he said, 'No, lest in gathering the weeds you root up the wheat along with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at harvest time, I will tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" One of the things I love about the Bible is that it's realistic. It's not a bunch of out-of-touch fairy tales. It describes life the way that it is. There's a field of wheat, and there's weeds that grow up with the wheat. Isn't that what we see in life? There are good things and there are bad things. We get tastes of heaven and we get tastes of hell. There's beauty in this world. There is horror. There is righteousness and evil. There is life and there is death. And it seems like things are never perfect. And if they are, they don't stay that way for very long. Things are good, but there always seems to be problems. The Sixers are the hottest team in basketball, but Embiid breaks his eye socket right before the playoffs. Thanks, Fultz. You finally buy a home, and then everything begins to break, sometimes all at once. You get a taste of heaven by eating a Tony Luke's cheesesteak, and later learn that you have high cholesterol that comes primarily from eating said cheesesteaks. You have a beautiful baby boy, but later find out he has learning disabilities. You have a close relationship with your mom, and she develops cancer and dies. there are some amazingly glorious things in this world. And there are some horribly painful and disappointing things in this world. But why is it that way? It doesn't make sense. If God is all powerful and all loving, why does God allow so many bad things? I mean, when you look at the world and all the weeds and all the bad people and the bad things, God's garden doesn't look very impressive. His wheat field has a lot of weeds running through it. My grandfather, who lived right next door, he had an amazing garden. He had a huge garden. People would actually stop their cars and just get out to look at his garden. He spent all of his free time in that garden. It was in perfect shape. Why would my grandfather's garden be in better shape than God's garden? What kind of a gardener would allow weeds to ruin everything? Why isn't God's world free from problems and evil? I mean, it seems like a mistake, or at least out of character with who we think God is. This isn't what I would do if I was God. You can see the confusion and almost accusation happening when the servants question the master. So in verse 27, when it says the servants said to him, "Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have weeds?" And master, what's going on here? What's happening? And we say the same thing to God. God, what are you doing? Why are you letting this happen? Why would you allow evil? And what are you going to do about it? I mean, surely you're going to do something about this, aren't you? Well, verses 28 to 30 give us a very definitive answer. It says, "So the servants said to him," said to the master, "then do you want us to go and gather them? But he said, no. Lest in gathering the weeds, you root up the wheat along with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at the harvest time, I will tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and bind them into bundles to be burned. But gather the wheat into my barn." Master, what are you going to do about the weeds? Nothing. God, aren't you going to do something about the problem of evil? Aren't you going to get rid of it? Can't we have a field where there's just good seed and good crops? Can't we have a world where everything is perfect? Can't we have a world without weeds and bad people and evil? God, aren't you going to do something about this? And God's response is, I'll tell you what I'm going to do about it. Nothing. He says, I'm going to do nothing about it right now. I'm going to let evil grow alongside of good. I'm going to allow weeds to grow. There's going to be good things that you experience and bad things. You're going to get taste of heaven and taste of hell. God tells us in this parable that this is going to happen, that this is how he's going to deal with things. He's going to be patient. He's going to allow his garden to get messed up a little bit. Weeds are going to happen. Now, this doesn't mean that God doesn't care or meet us in the midst of our suffering. No, he cares more than anyone has ever cared. And this also doesn't mean that God isn't in control. He's not helpless. He tells us that he's going to deal with evil at harvest time. In verses 36 through 43, Jesus actually explains this parable to us. We find out that the harvest represents the end of the age when Jesus returns, and that's when he will judge the world. So God is clearly in control. He's just delaying his response, which we don't like. But before I talk about our reaction to his delay, I want you to see something else. There is a real enemy at work. In verse 25, it says that while the men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed wheat. And then later in 28, the master says, an enemy has done this. God is at work planting wheat, and the enemy is planting weeds. There is a move by God and then a counter move by his enemy, Satan. Now, the idea of Satan may feel a little archaic to you, But I think we all know that there is an enemy. Wherever God is at work, the enemy is at work too. Satan is real, but he's a counterfeiter. He can't create things. He can only pervert and poison the things that God has made. He seeks to undo what God has done. Now, the name of the weed that the enemy sows in this parable is called darnel. It looks just like wheat when it first comes up, but you can't tell it's a weed until it's too late. And if you try to uproot it, you'll pull up the wheat because the roots are intertwined, they're entangled together. And this is a real problem if you have a garden. The last couple of years, my wife and I, Trish and I, we've had a really good crop of kale. So we have a little garden and the kale's been awesome. This year, for some reason, the weeds just came up, and the way it's planted, it's all these seeds that go in and then it comes up and you can't really tell. You can't start plucking until it gets bigger, and then you're doomed. It knocked this kale out. Weeds can be a major problem. And the weed darnel in this parable, it's poisonous if you eat it or if it's mixed with wheat. Have you noticed how Satan poisons things? He ruins things. He perverts and destroys things. God overflows with life and love and joy. Satan overflows with destruction and pain and hate. But understanding all this doesn't necessarily make it any easier to swallow. Why does God allow this? Why doesn't he just wipe Satan out? I mean, it's helpful that he tells us he's not going to take Satan out or deal with evil right now, but we still don't like the delay. It makes us think that God isn't powerful, or if he is, then he shouldn't be trusted. The fact that God doesn't deal with evil right now tempts us. God, there's evil in your world, and you seem to be fine with it. We're not fine with it. We're not fine with the good and bad growing up together. We get impatient with God. We can't stand this. And God seems perfectly content with waiting, but we sure aren't. We don't want to sort this out later. We want a world where everything goes right, not a world where both evil and good grow up together. And it seems like it's God's fault. But is God really responsible for all of it? In Genesis chapter 1, we see God creating the world and everything in it. He then plants a garden. It's called the Garden of Eden, and it is perfect. It is filled with the most delicious fruits and vegetables you can imagine. There is joy and laughter and love in the garden. There's no pain or sorrow or sadness or sickness, and there are no weeds. But in Genesis 3, the story changes. There's a counter move by Satan to destroy the goodness and joy that God has created. Adam and Eve are tempted, and they decide to turn their backs on God. They reject God. They blatantly disobey him. And their defiance of God brings sin into the entire human race. Their sin curses and poisons the earth and every person born on the earth. They brought sin into the world. Author C.S. Lewis, who wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, really brings this to life in The Magician's Nephew. Rob quoted from this series of books. It's an amazing set of children's books with tremendous insight on Christianity. The main character in this book is a boy named Diggory. And Diggory brings evil to life. He wakes the evil queen Jadis, the white witch, by breaking her spell. He was tempted and he rang this bell and she awoke. And then he let this evil witch into the brand new world of Narnia. And he's confronted over this by Aslan. Aslan is the Christ figure. And he says this to Diggory. He says, "Son of Adam, there is an evil witch abroad in my new land of Narnia. Tell these good beasts how she came here." And then there's a dialogue about what he did. And then he turns and he says, "You see, friends, that before the new clean world I gave you is 7 hours old, a force of evil has already entered it, waked and brought hither by this son of Adam. But do not be cast down. evil will come of that evil, but it is still a long way off, and I will see to it that the worst falls upon myself. Now, the amazing thing is that Aslan does not destroy the witch or deal with her right away, and she proceeds to cause great pain and suffering throughout Narnia. Diggory let this evil into the world. Through the sin of Adam and Eve, we let evil into the world. Yes, God allowed it, just as he allowed the weeds to grow up, but it was our fault. Now, you might say, okay, well, fine. So maybe we're partly to blame, but the questions still remain. Why doesn't God deal with evil right now? Why does he let them both grow up? Why does God allow good and evil to coexist? There's two reasons I find in this parable. The first is that he doesn't want to spoil the wheat. So number one, he doesn't want to spoil the wheat. We read about this in verses 28 and 29. Gathering the weeds runs the danger of uprooting the wheat. The roots of the wheat and weeds have become intertwined, so you can't just pull up the weeds. Well, the same is true in our lives. God intertwines our lives with suffering and trials. There's no such thing as a person that goes through life without being affected by sin and suffering and the curse on this planet. But God doesn't want to eliminate suffering from our lives because somehow suffering and evil can help us. How is that possible? Romans 8:28 says, "And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose." Now, this is not a promise for everyone. This is a promise for those who love God and are his genuine followers. And the promise is that he'll use all things for good. All things includes all things. Sin, suffering, evil committed against us, sickness, trials, disappointments, injuries, diseases, stress, financial struggles, broken dreams, betrayals, addictions, and death. God is so incredibly wise that he can use evil for good. And he's able to do it in a way where he's not responsible for the evil actions, but he remains sovereign and in control. He's not responsible for evil because he never commits sin or evil. He's God. And he's not just reacting to all the things that we do. No, he's orchestrating and directing all things according to his will. It really is amazing. God can take things that are really bad and make them turn out for good. I read this story years ago about a couple named George and Mirjana. This is a couple that found themselves in Yugoslavia during the Nazi regime where their country was occupied. George was an American student. He had his visa and his papers, and he fell in love with this girl. He married her, and they desperately tried to get out of Yugoslavia. They couldn't get out by car or train. Her dad was a very high political figure in Yugoslavia, and he was anti-Nazi. And if they found her, it would be terrible. So their only hope was to try to fly out. Listen to this story. George and Mirjana were eager to get on the plane and make the final leg of their roundabout journey out of Yugoslavia, but they were anxious also. Mirjana's documents might not be enough to get them through, and they knew it depended mostly on who was checking. If they had only a cursory look by the local authorities in Belgrade, there might not be any problem. But if the German authorities wanted to take a closer look, Mirjana could be spotted as a wanted person by the Gestapo. They would arrest her, and then George couldn't stand to think too much about what might happen to her. They were the last people to board the airplane, and the only two seats available were not together. One was open in the very front and one in the back. George and Mirjana didn't mind as long as they could get on their way, so they parted, and George took the seat in the rear, knowing that might be a bumpier ride. Mirjana sat up front next to a somewhat plump but well-dressed woman. They both tried to relax as the plane taxied down the runway and rose into the air. The plane hadn't been aloft long before George sensed something was amiss. From his seat in the rear, he could see Mirjana moving about in her seat, restless it seemed, and the woman next to her appeared to be helping her. The woman had a wet cloth she was holding to Mirjana's head while she patted the younger woman on the back. Mirjana's air sick, George thought. He had known this might be a problem because she had not flown much. George stood up and walked down the aisle to check on his wife. As he reached her seat, he bent down to see her and was surprised to see how pale and distraught she was. The woman in the next seat smiled at George and gave a sympathetic nod to Mirjana, taking the cloth away from the sick woman's forehead so the couple could speak. George immediately tried to comfort her. Mirjana, what's happening? She looked up at him, far more sick than he expected to see her, and said, I feel terrible, George. Why are you so sick, he asked. It's just the plane. You won't be sick for long. Mirjana didn't reply right away, and then she motioned for George to lean down closer. He did, and Mirjana leaned in to whisper into his ear, hoping the sound of the airplane engines would prevent anyone else from overhearing. Do you know who this is next to me? Mirjana whispered. George looked over at the woman who was quietly reading a book. He shook his head slightly to indicate that he had no idea. It's Mrs. Goebbels, Mirjana whispered intently, almost breaking into tears as she said it. The wife of Joseph Goebbels. George, I'm going to be arrested when we get to Belgrade. Stunned at the incredible bad luck of his wife to be sitting on a plane next to Magda Goebbels, the first lady of the Third Reich, wife of the fiery and charismatic propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, a top leader in the Nazi movement. Adolf Hitler had been a witness at their wedding, and in the 1930s, Magda Goebbels bore six children for Goebbels. With Hitler remaining unmarried, she was promoted as the first lady of the Third Reich. The Goebbels clan presented to the public as the model family for Germany. She looked like such a kind woman, George thought, but he knew better. In Hitler's bunker at the end of the war in 1945, this kind-looking woman would kill her six children one after another by crushing a cyanide capsule in their mouths. For the rest of the 40-minute flight, George could only sit and watch while his wife was comforted to no avail by the most revered woman in the Third Reich. As the plane touched down in Belgrade for refueling, it appeared Mirjana was near collapse, the stress of the moment about to overwhelm her. But he could do nothing without arousing suspicion, so he waited for the door in the rear of the plane to open, and then he was the first one to exit. His heart sank as he saw a German officer there waiting to check passports. He handed his over, and the officer let him pass. George stood nearby waiting for Mirjana, hoping this wasn't going to be the last time they saw each other. All the passengers came out of the rear door, the officer checking each passport, and finally George could see Mirjana coming down the aisle, Magda Goebbels' arm underneath hers, helping steady the sick woman. As they came to the door, the officer called out, "Passports, please," as he had with everyone else. George looked at Mirjana, and they both thought this was the moment they had been dreading. Then Magda Goebbels shouted crossly at the officer. "What do you mean, passport?" she said sternly in the tone of a woman used to berating Nazi officers and getting away with it. "This is the wife of that man standing there next to you. She's sick. Help me with this woman or you will hear from me." The officer did as he was told and helped Mirjana out of the plane, forgetting all about the passports. Mirjana walked to George and they embraced, no one around them knowing why they were so relieved. Magda Goebbels wished them well and went toward the airport terminal. George and Mirjana couldn't believe that Magda Goebbels had just saved them. There are many ways that God uses things that seem bad for our good. And in reality, we can't even always distinguish between good and bad. We like to have very clear divisions between good and bad and segment them into different categories. In category one, all the good things in the world. Chipotle, Netflix, a nice yard, the beach. Category two, all the bad things. Mondays, sickness, tofu burgers, and the New York Giants. But in the real world, it's a lot more complicated than that. We often can't determine what is good and bad because we don't always know what God is up to. We want clear distinctions, but it can be complicated. But there is one thing we do know. God can use suffering for good. For instance, he can use suffering to bring you to himself. When you're doing well and everything's going your way, you don't really feel a need for God. But when things are going badly, you become desperate. What you're doing isn't working out so well, so you turn elsewhere. You don't have to turn to God. In fact, most people don't. They just get angry at God and distance themselves. But God can use suffering to bring you to himself. Isn't that true, church? Raise your hand if you would say God has used suffering to bring you to himself. Yeah, thank you. God can also use suffering to make us long for our true home, to make us long for a world without evil. Did you know that you were not created for this world? God created earth as a temporary home. Your true home is in a place with God in heaven. It's actually called the new heavens and the new earth in Revelation 21. It's God's world coming down into our world. And it's like our world on steroids, more beautiful and peaceful and spectacular than anything you've ever seen. And God will come to dwell with us on this new earth. It will be so spectacular that we'll forget about the problems that we faced here on this earth. This earth is not meant to be heaven. It's not meant to be perfect. It's meant to be temporary. We're supposed to be just kind of passing through. And so God sends trials to us to detach us from this earth and make us long for our true home. Trials can cause us to long for and live for heaven. And God can also use suffering to mature us. In suffering, we learn perseverance. Like a boxer, we learn how to take a punch. We toughen up. Perseverance matures us. It breaks the grip on our selfishness and pride. We learn to trust God, and we grow in patience. God uses evil for our good. The greatest example of God using evil for good is found in the Bible. It's when Satan and the Jews and the Romans teamed up to crucify Jesus. They thought they were getting rid of an enemy, but instead they were putting to death the Son of God. But the death of Jesus was not a mistake. It wasn't an accident. It was the most important event in the history of the world. The pain and agony that Jesus endured on the cross brought forgiveness and eternal life to a world that had no way of saving itself. The death of Jesus paid for the debt of sins that we owe. The death of Jesus purchased forgiveness and righteousness for those who trust in him. God used the greatest evil to bring about the greatest good. So that's number one. Why does God allow good and evil to coexist? He doesn't want to spoil the wheat. There's good that can come out of it. Number two, this is the last point. He will deal with evil in the end. He'll deal with it in the end. You may not like God's plan, but that doesn't mean that it's unfair or unjust. God's patience and his ability to use evil for good might not be what we would choose, but it's God's plan. He decided to do it that way, and he tells us in this parable so that we know that it's his plan. It's not a mistake. Verse 30, let both grow together. Let both grow together until the harvest. That's when Jesus returns. Now, it's important to understand, nobody's going to get away with anything in the end. God is a perfectly just God. There will be justice in the end. God doesn't settle all his accounts in the present, but he will in the future. There's a story told of a farmer in the Midwest who had a strong disdain for God and anything that had to do with church. As he would plow his field on Sunday mornings, he would shake his fist at the church people who passed by on their way to worship. October came and the farmer had his finest crop ever, the best in the entire county. So when the harvest was complete, he placed an ad in the local paper which belittled Christians for their faith in God. Near the end of his diatribe, he wrote, "Faith in God must not mean much if someone like me can prosper the way that I did." The response from the Christians in the community was quiet and polite. In the next edition of the town paper, a small response appeared. It read simply, "God doesn't settle all his accounts in October." God doesn't settle all his accounts in October. Everything will be made right in the end. If you're worried about justice, you don't have to be. God is a just God. You are not more just and righteous than God. You're just impatient. You might think it would be better to clean it all up now and make things perfect, but God's decided to do that later. And that perfection that you long for is heaven. And it waits in the future for those who fully trust in Jesus. But for those who do not fully trust in Jesus, something awful awaits. In verse 40, when Jesus is explaining this parable, he says, just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so will it be at the close of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. All causes of sin and all lawbreakers will be dealt with in the end. Hell is a place where evil will be locked up once and for all. Now, you might think, well, good, we need to punish the lawbreakers. We need to punish the evil people who keep making a mess of this world. Be careful what you wish for. The Hooters sang a song called All You Zombies, and one of the lines in it is, the peace is going to fall on you. And they're talking there about the law, the Ten Commandments. Be careful. Judgment is going to come back on you. See, here's the problem. We're the lawbreakers. We break God's law. Don't believe me? Have you ever told a lie? Ever got angry at someone? Ever lusted? Ever coveted? Ever loved something more than you love God? Then you're a lawbreaker. And those aren't the only things that God forbids. Have you ever been prideful? Have you ever complained? Have you ever been selfish or argumentative? So have I. And that means, like me, you're a sinner and a lawbreaker. We all are. No one in this room is exempt. And the problem isn't just that we sin. It's that sin has terrible consequences, punishment, eternal punishment in hell. So what do we do? Well, verse 43 says, then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear. Well, we've already established that we're not righteous. We're actually unrighteous. How do we become righteous so we can be included in the kingdom of the Father, so that we can shine like the sun in heaven? How can we be the wheat and not the weeds? Well, let me take you back to the story of Narnia. Diggory had brought evil into the world, but he couldn't get it out. He needed Aslan to deal with sin and make all things right. And that's why Aslan says, do not be cast down. Evil will come of that evil, but it is still a long way off. And I will see to it that the worst falls upon myself. And in the next book, Aslan sacrificially lays down his life to defeat sin and evil. There are bad things that fall upon us, but the worst has fallen upon Christ. The worst of it has fallen upon him. We can't erase our sin. We can't erase the evil in our hearts. We don't have the ability to be righteous or good enough to get to God. We deserve to be burned like the weeds. But God did something about this. 2,000 years ago, he came down to earth. He was born in Bethlehem, and he was born to die. Jesus was tortured and hung on a Roman cross to make all things right. He saw that the worst fell to him. He took the evil and sin of this world on himself. He took our sin and our shame on himself. He wore our sin on the cross, and he took the punishment that we deserve for all our sins and lawlessness. He took our hell. He died so that God would look on us not as weeds deserving punishment, but as the wheat to be gathered into the barn. He died so that we could be accepted by God as our Father. He died to rescue us from hell and to give us an eternal home in heaven with him. Let's pray.